This episode is sponsored by Gusto, online payroll and benefits software built for small businesses. You're listening to the Parsed Examine Life, episode 387, part 2. We're still discussing Hegel on spirit. We are up to section 469, I believe. Yeah. I think we've sort of said, but we haven't given this Oedipus metaphor.
Yeah, here he builds upon this idea of guilt. That's what we were discussing 468, where guilt first comes up. Here he's going to say these two, we're going to make the unconscious conscious, but we only do that by producing this other one who has been wronged and is retaliating against us. So the two laws, the human and the divine law, are essentially connected. And carrying out one sort of activates the other in opposition. So the agent who has been unconscious of that other side, once they act, they become conscious of it. And they become conscious of it in the form of their crime, in the form of their guilt. So yeah. So what's the, remind me of the Oedipus reference here.
Just that, like the realization that Oedipus has done something wrong, the unconscious power snares the doer in the act. The accomplished deed is the removal of the antithesis between the knowing self and the actually confronting it, and the actuality confronting it. The doer cannot deny the crime or his guilt.
Yeah. So you're saying an implicit Oedipus reference.
I thought it was explicit, but I don't see the word Oedipus there.
But does he use the name Oedipus? Okay, I'm just...
He says the son does not recognize the father in the man who has wronged him and whom he slays, nor his mother in the queen who makes his wife. That's not ambiguous.
I think he's just tilting gently.
Well, my notes have Oedipus in it, but I'm having trouble seeing it in this paragraph because all my highlights
the
on this
name is not here, as usual. Yeah. He assumes you know the story.
If you don't think that's explicit enough, and
no,
it is
explicit.
Oedipus,
I'm just curious. No, I have it in my notes. I immediately translated. Oedipus doesn't recognize
all the time.
His father and the man he kills, or his mother and the woman he marries. All right. I recognize that, but I just was coming back to this. I was curious if he actually uses the name, but of course he doesn't. But you know, this is as explicit as Hegel gets, though, as with a reference.
Yes, Seth earlier talked about this as that there's this kind of poetical thing, and I guess it feels like, just as a comment, feels like a kind of ecstatic stream of thought from a pulpit when I'm reading this, like a poetical trance that he's gone into.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I think it's an act of genius. I think I've concluded, yes, this is all an act of genius, but it's frustrating to read. And it, you know, I noticed, like, even as I start paraphrasing, you know, in my notes, even if I'm still speaking Hegelese, I'm still improving it dramatically, just syntactically and in terms of ambiguous pronouns and clarity. It's not hard to improve it and to see he's doing an amazing job of being a genius, but he's not doing a good job of communicating it. But yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like when you get caught up in such a high level of thinking, right, he's noticing this really interesting parallel between ontology and the social order or social ontology, right? This conflict between universal and particular with which we started the book. That shows up socially, that is inherently a part of the ethical. So it's really, it cues us into how deep the things we experience in the ethical world are, how they're grounded in something much deeper. They're grounded in the nature of being itself. So someone who's trying to think that abstractly, he doesn't have time to to communicate it properly.
Yeah.
Well, and if this sounds really weird, just to refresh people, right? When you act, aren't you just acting yourself as an individual? No, because you're using some maxim, you're drawing on something. So this is a Kantian thought, Sartre runs with it, Hegel is running with it here as well. Hegel would put it, it's spirit acting through you, but Kant would put it that you are positing that everyone should act like this. So you are always acting from a universal point of view insofar as you're at least acting ethically at all.
Well, that's interesting putting it that way, because you're just saying that to act ethically is to act with the presumption of the universal, as opposed to, so there would never be possible to have an individual ethic.
Right. So every time you think that you're being all individual, you are fooling yourself.
Yeah. And in 471, right, we lose individual identity suddenly because of the acknowledgement, because we now know, because now we have become conscious of the other side, we're no longer just submerged in the ethical role that we were fulfilling. Our law, you know, even if we say, yeah, the other side is BS, right? We can't be as confident in our own law. And so then there's this fallback into pathos and into character, right? So the thing that was supposed to be an action, and an action in terms of representative of some social role, is now just representative of individual character and feeling. So it's reduced to a mere feeling or inner attitude. How does he, that's my notes, how does he put it in 471?
The substance does appear, it is true, in the individuality as his pathos, and the individuality appears as that which animates the substance and hence stands above it. But the substance is a pathos that is at the same time his character. I found this a very difficult passage.
The ethical individuality is directly and intrinsically one with this his universal aspect, exists in it alone, and is incapable of surviving the destruction of this ethical power by its opposite. To me, the arc of this section is just this loss of individual identity, but because it collapses, right, individuality in the truest existential sense, but it's no longer because we are defined in terms of social roles, because we're defined in terms of our individual character and pathos. And that's because that's a direct result of becoming guilty and aware of the other, the opposing side.
I think this ties back to, you're right, it's still in the arc, Wes, of the move from determined character versus willing personality or something like that, that movement. There's a section earlier, slightly earlier, where he talks about a kind of like universal individuality versus this particular individual. So almost like the concept of individuality versus an actual specific individual person, and that the transition out of the ethical is the transition from this abstract universal individuality to particularity. And that seems to be what he's talking about here, is that in that deed, right, the character, this universal individuality, I know it's an oxymoron, but is destroyed. And what happens is that the individual is then kind of thrown back on themselves to become a particular individual. And that's where this pathos sort of emerges. And that's how we're going to get to the possibility of personality and individuality that we see in the later section of the law.
In acknowledging the opposite law, the other ceases to be for him his substance. And instead of attaining actuality, it has become an unreality, a sentiment or disposition. So, you know, that Antigone, she's crazy. She's just worked up, right? That's what the other becomes for Creon. And she can say that this is about their obstinance again, right? They're merely being a force of nature or some kind of arbitrary force as opposed to standing for something. So Creon is just a abuser of power, and Antigone is just stubborn. That's pathos here. And that's part of the dynamics of the actual play, right? These are characters in a play, and it's all about feeling, right? This is why Plato wanted to banish the poets from the city, because of the dangerousness of our identification with one form of pathos or another. And I'm going to continue to pronounce it in the hybrid way. Mark has pointed out that this is a hybrid between British and American pronunciation.
I just was wondering, because I never actually knew. I thought it was like these Greek words, like, well, people pronounce the Greek words however they want because, you know, we don't know how the ancient Greeks pronounced them. But it's either pathos or pathos. It's
in the ancient Greek, it's pathos. And the accent would be on the path. Pathos. All right. So 472. We get more pathos. Now I can't even remember how to pronounce it. Pathos.
We don't care. So yeah, we reading about 5-6 lines down into page 285, the equal essentiality of both, right? The two types of law as motivations and their indifferent existence alongside each other means that they are without a self. In the deed, they exist as beings with a self, but with a diverse self. And this contradicts the unity of the self and constitutes their unrighteousness and necessary destruction. So clearly we're not talking about an individual. This individual does not have a self. It is, the individual self is supposed to be the unified self of spirit. It's supposed to be the whole ethical thing is just spirit acting in its unified way. But because it has these two strands, then the spirit no longer has a coherent single self. It has a diverse self. In other words, multiple people with different points of view.
I think, though, well, maybe I'm going to find out I'm wrong here, but I think that's true. But also reading it at the individual level, we get a split, I thought, between consciousness and unconsciousness here again. Doesn't he mention that?
In step 473, the conflict of the ethical order and self-consciousness with unconscious nature. Or am I missing what you were?
Well, I think I have it in 472 as well, unless my notes just read ahead to that. So,
well, at the bottom of 472, the victory of one power and its character and the defeat of the other.
One character, like the other, is split up into a conscious and an unconscious part.
Mm-hmm.
So I would take both Creon and Antigone to be split now. And since each itself calls forth this opposition, and its not knowing is, through the deed, its own affair, each is responsible for the guilt, which destroys it, right? So divine law calls up human law and vice versa. Creon calls up Antigone and vice versa. They inevitably posit or produce one another. Only in the downfall of both sides alike is absolute right accomplished, and the ethical substance is the negative power which engulfs both sides. That is, omnipotent and righteous destiny steps on the scene. This is like big plot point in this section. Suddenly, here comes destiny, which is what happens to Oedipus. He can't outrun the inevitability of guilt. He can't outrun the inevitability.
Do you think any theaters at some point were like, you know, at the end of Antigone, it's too depressing. Can you just have Creon and Antigone hook up? Just change, you know.
They're actually, isn't he her uncle?
I mean, maybe.
No, it's Creon's
I don't know. Brother of I don't remember.
They are related in some way, but anyway.
Doesn't stop. Oedipus just says, this is the new way. This is the Targaryen way. You marry your mother.
Yeah, like father, like daughter.
This is the harmony that needs to be disturbed through the tension.
Keep it in the family.
473.
Yeah, now he expands this conflict to one between the natural and the contingent and the ethical. And then we get to the point where the government, which is a unitary thing, won't tolerate the contingency of these two battling brothers because it imperils the community. So they mutually destroy one another, which is to say the community and the individual are mutually destroyed.
I was reading this as Cain and Abel, but obviously they're two brothers in Antigone, you know, before the action starts in the play. So, but I think it works equally well.
Well, they have been, no, I think this is important because the brothers have been fighting over who's going to be king of the community. And that's how Polynices is killed. So he's killed by, well, they both die. So I took this as, yeah, this reference to the battling brothers is between those two brothers.
This is interesting. So this page 285, section 473, PDF 321. The youth comes away from the unconscious spirit of the family and becomes the individuality of the community, but that he still belongs to the nature from which he wrenched himself free is evidenced by the fact that he emerges in the contingent form of two brothers. So the youth becomes two brothers, each of whom with equal right takes possession of the community. The inequality of the earlier and later birth, an inequality which is a natural difference, has no importance for them when they enter the ethical life of the community.
Yeah, so this seems more fundamental than, you know, that the particular story of Antigone or even Cain and Abel, that it is the mere fact of multiplicity. It's like the master-slave, you know, just when two individuals appear on the scene, there's going to be some sort of, right, the government as a unitary soul or the self of the national spirit does not tolerate a duality of individuality.
Well, I was just thinking, like, when you think in terms of, he's talking about birth order. So if you think in terms of like the natural law, the divine law of the family, the oldest son becomes the head of the household, inherits all of the goods, blah, blah, blah. But he's saying, but when at this level of government that we're talking about, if they both brothers, if the an older and a younger brother, first and second son go out into the community, they're both citizens by right. But later on, right, birth order is going to matter for the social. It is going to matter for government, because once you have the divine right of kings and the lineage of royal houses, right? The first son is going to become the king. And so it actually will matter. There's going to be this evolution. So I felt like he's actually setting that up to some extent in this section.
So I do want to just highlight this is very explicitly a reference to the two brothers, Polynices and Eteocles. How do you pronounce it? Eteocles? And then as Mark points out, yeah, there's a much more fundamental, right, as always, that it's a metaphor for something much more fundamental. But he'll say here the birth order is not actually ethically significant. I forget which one is older. I assume it's Eteocles. But these two brothers, they represent the kind of duality of individuality and the fact that it's a natural accident. But the individual is a natural accident, and the government, as a unitary soul of national spirit, can't tolerate that. They can't tolerate individuality in this sense. And the fact that they both, in a way, have an equal right to the state, that's the whole point of mentioning that it's the birth order is ethically significant, is that Hegel wants to emphasize the way in which they both have an equal right. We can't just say one had a right and the other didn't. I think that's a stretch. But that's necessary to his story, right? Otherwise, you can't just have this battle between two contingencies where the ethics is irrelevant. So their equal right to the state destroys them both. Polynices is the one that, right, was the attacker in the way. And so he becomes the attacker of the community. And Eteocles is the one who has the right on his side. But ultimately, each is wrong. Each destroys each other. Yeah, right. The one who has refused the burial honor, Polynices, he's refused it because, in a sense, he's attacking spirit. He who wantonly attacked the spirit's highest form of consciousness, the spirit of the community, must be stripped of the honor of his entire and finished being, the honor due to the spirit of the departed. So that's the burial denial. I know that's not very clear, but the section is very, you know, it's very unclear.
No, I mean, you read just about all of the section there. So 474, I have divine law as the essential power. It cannot be destroyed by self-conscious spirit, secular law. The divine law stands up to the secular through the bloodless shade, right? The actual person who's actually subject to both. The secular seems to win over the divine law because, right, the divine is just weakness and darkness, unconsciousness. But the outwardly actual, the secular law, which is taken away from the inner world, its honor and power, has in doing so consumed its own essence, right? Because the publicly manifest spirit has its root in the power of the netherworld. I feel like we've said this.
Yeah. So in overcoming the individuality in the family, right, spirit, self-conscious spirit consumes its own essence, which turns out to be the unconscious solidarity of the nation. So this is what I was mentioning before. You rob the political order of this folk solidarity once you overcome the divine law, right? It's just going to be a republic now or whatever. It's not going to be a true nation once you do this.
I was thinking throughout this of H.L. Hart's from our philosophy of law episode that, you know, what makes law efficacious for him is that we have internalized it. It's not just some alienated thing imposed upon us, but something that we are. You know, so that's, I think, the point about the divine law being rooted in us and it having a necessary connection to secular law. And if it doesn't, if the human law has become divorced from that, then that's where alienation takes place. And that necessarily happens in the modern world, if only because there are so many people that you can't, per Rousseau, actually have the human law be the general will representing the deep moral convictions of every single member of the community. It's just not going to happen. Too much diversity for that.
In 475, we're going to get to a part of the gist of this is that the suppression of the divine law and along with it, womankind as the representative of the divine law will be the destruction of the community because it leads to war in part, right? And the contingencies of physical strength. And we can't, it's a contingency and a matter of luck. I think he uses the word luck here, at least later on. The suppression of one side is ultimately self-defeating. And part of this is so womankind endorses the power of youth against wisdom, against the conservative element in society. Women are corrupting the youth. Not exactly. She values the youthful son that she's going to send out into the world to become a citizen. But ultimately, it becomes something subversive. Rock and roll, for instance. Youth culture. So the family and the divine law become this instrument of the youthful subversion of the traditional.
I think we talked about this a little bit last time, or maybe I did, that the family is critical, right, to the nation in the sense that the family has to produce the citizens. And so there's this, again, a kind of inherent tension where the family is sort of different from and at odds with the nation, and yet at the same time secured by it. People depart the family, men depart the family to enter the life of the nation, ultimately return to the family, but still have to return to the family because they have to create new family members. And the women of the family sort of participate vicariously, if you will, in some sense, through their sons. And, you know, he acknowledges that this is not like a true, complete kind of fulfillment. It's not the same as actually going out and participating. And that's problematic. But it's just this. And so, again, they're not going to be static in the sense that there will eventually, right? It makes sense that there would be a tension and that you would have youth rebellion in some sort, because the same tension that exists between the parents and the children is going to manifest between the children as the representation of the family and the state.
The young men who have been turned out now become sort of the vehicles of the life of spirit, I think. So he'll say in a sense that because you suppress the divine law, the dynamism within that, the work that's done, the energy of that gets channeled into these youth who are being injected into society. And society, in a way, lives through their youth in the sense of their military prowess. And so in a way, they become the concentrated vehicles of spirit, of the thickness that's been lost by the community. In a way, it's a last dash effort to say, war. And so he'll say, let's see, the brave youth in whom the woman finds her pleasure, the suppressed principle of corruption, now has his day and his worth is openly acknowledged. Now it is physical strength and what appears as a matter of luck that decides the existence of ethical life and spiritual necessity. And I took this ultimately to be a reference to war. Because the existence of ethical life rests on strength and luck, the decision is already made that its downfall has come. You can't simply rely on this form of power. The living spirits of the nation succumb through their own individuality and perish in universal community, whose simple universality is soulless and dead and is alive only in the single individual, qua single. The ethical shape of spirit has vanished and another takes its place.
Yeah, this is explicitly about war, which he refers to at the top of 289, the absolute freedom of the ethical self from every existential form present in its actual and authentic existence. So again, we're kind of like the master-slave thing, that war is the, I'm trying to think of what the blacksmithing analogy is, but the fire in which you are plunged in.
The forge?
Yes, the forge.
War makes the individual systems of property and personal independence, as well as the personality of the individual himself, feel the power of the negative. This negativity is prominent in war as that which preserves the whole, right? Yeah, so you have a master. He makes a direct comparison later on. But yeah, this is a master-slave dynamic, which is meant to preserve the whole, but produces downfall. And so the, you know, in 476, the vanishing of the nation, or the destruction of the community, will lead to the thinning, what I would call the thinning of the individual himself. He loses, like the community, he's going to lose his thickness and get closer to being the person, which is a term of contempt.
Yeah, that's funny. It's like the using the word competent, which I like to see as a compliment. But then I was using that in some work setting, like, No, that sounds like merely competent, you know? So it's like, if you're just a person, right. So a person should sound like, that's the locus of all value. That's the Kantian, you know, treat everybody as a person. But if you are merely a person and don't have any specific characteristics that are admirable or noteworthy, then that's a very thin indeed.
He sets up this opposition here between the natural and unconscious tranquility of the nation, which I take to be the nation, and the tranquility of self-consciousness. And these two, are, because they are in contradiction, lead again to this destruction of the nation, which vanishes into the individual. And then the individual takes on this formal, universality and what he calls an immediate attitude towards the law, right? Which is very much like it's going to be Rome, but it's very much like the Kantian attitude towards the law, which is not as something which is part of me, right? That's in my bones, but just this thing out there. It's a formal thing to be obeyed.
I'm not sure why you're saying that's Kantian, because Kant ultimately, per Kierkegaard, is about internalizing that, but it is the alienated version moment.
Well, he's going to make similar accusations towards Kant, right? Because we're not, it's all just, it's a very old, very, very tried and true accusation against Kant. Oh, it's all cold. It's all about rationality and what's not self-contradictory and with the law and all that.
Yes. So the last part of this, the substance is no longer a living spirit dwelling in each person, but instead, quote, the simple compactness of their individuality has been shattered into a multitude of separate atoms.
Yeah. So this word atomization, which becomes a big part, right, of post-Marxian cultural commentary, Hannah Arendt uses it. I was surprised that it's already right here in Hegel. It's just being picked up from him. And the whole theme of what we're going to get to now with legal status has a lot to do with atomization.
Yes. So our final topic here, this section C, legal status, which we sort of just added because we had, we didn't have enough pages without this, but it does complete the story, right? We've set up that alienation has happened. So what do we have? We have, they see what's left is the soulless community, right? The community has ceased to be the unconscious substance of individuals. Individuals now have the value of selves and substances, possessing a separate being for self. So I actually like this, right? That this is the individual, the liberal modern individual who is not beholden to merely act out the dictates of spirit, but who can make their own decisions. But yet this is something Hegel thinks is contemptible and incomplete.
I mean, it sounds like a success in a way, right? Because he'll say the familial individual has emerged from his unreal existence, right? Into self-certainty,
yeah,
as substance. But there's a downside.
And now a word from our sponsor. Nothing hits like home cooking, and honestly, that's always been true for me. I've been cooking for over 30 years, taking classes, reading cookbooks, watching all the cooking shows, and it's something I genuinely love, especially cooking for my family or having a few people over. And even on a busy weeknight, there's something really satisfying about putting together a good meal and sitting down together. That's actually why I use HelloFresh. It kind of gives me the best of both worlds. I get to do the part I enjoy, the cooking, but it takes care of the shopping and all the prep a few days a week, which is a huge relief. And it keeps things interesting. You can choose from more than 100 recipes every week with all kinds of different cuisines, so you're not stuck making the same thing over and over. The portions are great too, definitely enough to satisfy everyone at the table. I also like that it fits how people want to eat right now. There are more than 35 high-protein recipes each week, plus Mediterranean and GLP-1 friendly options, and the ingredients are really solid, like sustainably sourced seafood and chicken that's 100% antibiotic and hormone-free. And you can taste the difference. They've got way more seafood now, no extra cost, and things like grass-fed steak ribeyes if you want to make something a little special. Plus, everything's built around fresh, seasonal produce, which I always appreciate. Go to HelloFresh.com/PEL10FM to get 10 free meals, plus a free Zwilling knife, a $144.99 value on your third box. Offer valid while supplies last. Free meals applied at the discount on the first box. New subscribers only. Varies by plan.
I handle payroll for our little company. It's just an idiosyncratic Excel document that luckily only three other people need to understand at least a little. Were we to get a bunch more employees, I would absolutely have to find something like today's sponsor, Gusto. Gusto is online payroll and benefit software built for small businesses. It's all-in-one, remote-friendly, and incredibly easy to use, so you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. We use Gusto at my day job, where different employees live in different states, where some people get paid every other week, some people get paid monthly. Gusto is very flexible as far as payroll is concerned. And here's where my little Excel spreadsheet would not work at all. Gusto includes automatic payroll tax filing, direct deposits, health benefits, commuter benefits, workers' comp, 401k. Gusto tracks all the regulatory stuff having to do with all this. You can easily connect it with an expenses system. It's got shift scheduling, time logging, offer letters, onboarding docs, direct access to certified HR experts. It is super quick and simple to switch to Gusto. Now, here's the best thing. You can look at all these things on the site, set it up for your use, and you don't pay a cent until you run your first payroll. So there is no risk. Gusto is the number one payroll software, according to G2 for fall 2025, and trusted by over 400,000 small businesses. Try Gusto today at gusto.com/PEL and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/PEL. One more time, gusto.com/PEL.
There is a force that motivates Hegel's dialectic in the phenomenology of spirit. It's an unease with self, a lack of certainty about identity, a question of what if I'm not at home with myself. This feeling is the essential state of self-consciousness. If you are self-conscious about starting a new creative project, business, or other endeavor, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Like self-consciousness in the Hegelian dialectic, you must push through this doubt and uncertainty to achieve the synthesis of absolute spirit. And to do this, you need Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. Are you worried about getting off the schneid? Shopify has hundreds of ready-to-use templates that help you build a beautiful online store that matches your brand style. Are you wondering how you can do it all yourself? Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools informed by Shopify's commerce expertise. Concerned that people don't know your brand? Shopify helps you find customers with easy-to-run email and social media campaigns. And most importantly, are you feeling alone? Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And you get that iconic purple Shop Pay button used by millions of businesses and recognized by millions more customers. It means you're never alone, never unrecognized, and offers the best converting checkout on the planet. It's time to auf Hebung and turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/PEL. Go to shopify.com/PEL. That's shopify.com/PEL.
At this point, it feels like we're at the Enlightenment. We're at the birth of liberal democracy, right? Or liberalism is something we would recognize. Hegel doesn't live in a world of liberal democracy himself, right? But it feels like a kind of communitarian critique of the foundations of the problem of individuality and liberalism. And that, you know, all you end up is with thin selves. I mean, if I just sort of take on, you know, Sandel or, you know, any number of other communitarian critiques of the problem of the thinness of self in a liberal society, it's in that Hegel's just, you know, in whatever it is, 1812, saying that's the problem with liberalism, is it's not going to succeed because it's not tied down enough.
Would have been interesting if we had that discussion with Sandel after having just read this and we're bringing into his, like, oh yeah, you're right. The people in the community have to be hooked up to the divine law. Like, that would not really rhetorically help his position.
But it is that, yeah, we need something, you know, that is the whole communitarian critique, right? We need to be more like a family. We need more divine law. But yeah, I mean, I do think we are on track to Rome here, and the Roman Republic, it's not exactly what we would call liberal democracy, but it is very focused on ideas like freedom and rights and the citizen. It's really the rights of the aristocracy. But so it does, I think you're right, it prefigures a critique of liberalism. But I imagine we're probably going to get a more explicit critique in the alienation section, which is about the Enlightenment specifically.
But yeah. And his consequence is the terror of the French Revolution is the problem.
Yeah, eventually that's going to be the end of the whole spirit chapter.
That's what happens when you have too much rock and roll and too much individuality, is you get the terror of the French Revolution and lots of beheadings.
At least the individual is not the mere shadow that the individual was in the previous stage that is just acting out spirit. Now, you know, this is the individual has withdrawn into the certainty of himself. He is that substance as the positive universal. He has emerged from the family, from his unreal existence, right? So it sounds like he's saying a positive thing there.
Yeah. And then it sounds like he continues with this. There's something positive, but there's something negative, right? So in 478, the individual has become in and for itself, but also is an abstract universality and a rigid, unyielding self. And this is what's going to give rise to the emperor, right? Because of the lord of the world is Seth reminded us. It's because all the content, all the thickness is going to get ejected outward, all the power into one particular personality. Hey, I'm just a citizen of the Republic, right? I'm not a full thick person. Where does the thickness go? It ends up going into one guy.
I want to dwell for another second just on something from 477 here, just that, right? We had said previously, destiny has swallowed up the powers and the shapes of the ethical world, right? The two, the unconscious divine law and the secular law, they were destined to conflict in this explosive way. So the power of the ethical world is the substance reflected into its simple unitary nature, but that being which is reflected back into itself, that very necessity of blank destiny is nothing else but the eye of self-consciousness. That is a profoundly weird thing to say, to say that just because destiny sort of set up the conditions for the building of the I, the single individual divorced from spirit. So the I is the very necessity of blank destiny. I mean, is it just, am I just saying it's the necessary causal result of destiny? Or is it, or can we say stronger that the I is the destiny or the necessity of destiny?
I think there's a good analytic philosophy paper to be written on this.
I don't think so. I think the analytic philosopher would say this is nonsense.
Is he saying it's constitutive or is it causal? Yes, if it's constitutive, the analytic philosopher would probably say it's nonsense. But yeah. Is the I nothing but the necessity of destiny, or is it just an inevitable result? Probably just an inevitable result.
I mean, at least rhetorically supports the Roman Empire sees himself, right, as a living god, as the embodiment of destiny, right, as the one who no longer, you know, in the master-slave situation, he is the ultimate master, has no resistance from anything. So he's not actually going to develop a self-reflective self, but, you know, has emerged to be in this position as the result of destiny.
Or is it his density?
He is thick.
I am the law.
So in 479, we get a comparison to lordship and bondage. So just as self-consciousness emerges from lordship and bondage, here we have this true sense of independence that is much more advanced than the Stoic's independence, right? The Stoic is all about, well, for purposes of value, the world doesn't matter to me. It's all about my particular ethical character, which degenerates, as I'll point out here, into skepticism, where nothing, right, nothing is outside of me is real. Those are two kind of degraded or corrupt forms of independence. But here we get something truer and much more like what emerges after the lordship and bondage struggle. And it has, you know, its significance, its positive significance is, right, rights. Right, we get something recognized here. That's why there's the parallel to the recognition of lordship and bondage. What's recognized in persons are rights.
Yeah, if there's one thing that I feel like I've really gotten out of this revisiting Hegel, it is that I didn't understand well enough the lordship and bondage section that I had started with, you know, the first thing I learned about this book, because I thought that what come out of that is a full self. And I didn't take him at his word that, no, you don't come out with a full self. You get the Stoic self. You get a little fragment of something that is not connected to spirit. It's not motivated by anything. It just says the rest of the world doesn't matter. So it is denying a really huge part of itself. And it's only now in the spirit section that he's talking about actual people with personalities in a real society. And it's only at this stage of the spirit where we get, you know, actually self-conscious individuals. So you thought maybe out of lordship and bondage, you could just gain self-consciousness. Now you're a person. But no, we have to have another 100 pages in between, or, you know, 300 pages.
I mean, I do think he uses, right, he does say it's self-consciousness. But as we learn, right, there's many, many different kinds of self-consciousness. And he's used the phrase self-consciousness over and over again in the previous parts of just the section that we're reading. And it always turns out to be a disappointing version of self-consciousness.
It's almost as if your self-consciousness is always involves only partial examination.
I see what until
you become the absolute spirit.
The fully.
So that is where we're going with this podcast, is eventually the asymptotal end of this podcast will be.
Yeah, when we're 80 or whenever it is that we decide to shut it down. We can just have an episode where we declare victory. Full examination.
I declare self-consciousness. I declare absolute self-consciousness in the true substance of the spirit. So I think we should actually, you know, he does speak somewhat extensively about the analogy between what happens when he was talking about Stoicism and what's happening here. So it might pay to turn to that.
Yeah, he goes into that in 480, right? More of that.
Mm-hmm.
So this last form of independence that we're getting recapitulates this the development of Stoic independence, right? This and the development of that into the absolute independence of skepticism. But it gives us these legal rights which make the person an empty unit, and where the content is all set free, right? And we know it's going to go into the emperor. It's like this formal legal right, and it has no content like skepticism. And he makes this really interesting comparison between, right, in skepticism, all we have is this kind of, we have property. It's almost like property rights under capitalism or whatever, because it's, or liberalism, it's empty property because it's all just illusory appearances. Appearances are commodities. It's empty. But again, at the end of this section, he's going to make this point about there is a positive value, and that's in the recognition of rights. But the person loses their content. And ironically, it goes into someone who's going to suppress all their rights.
I do want to say something just about the language you guys are using, positive and negative. Like, I think he's...
I'm directly quoting, by the way, just so you know.
No, I know. But I want to talk about the way he's using it, because it sounds like, it, you know, when you're like, oh, and he hates this, he hates liberal democracy, and he hates this, and he hates that. He's describing this movement, and it's like, this thing, I think he's trying to make sure that you're cautious and aware that the movement towards something that you might perceive as being the resolution of the answer, Mark, like, oh, after lordship and bondage, we have self-consciousness. And he's like, no. You know, we have a form. He's like, this self-consciousness still has problems. He's just trying to talk about positive and negative to create the tension for movement. But ultimately, you know, he's just basically trying to be cautious and saying, like, every stage we're moving to has a problem within it, or has a contradiction inherent in it that's going to force us to move on from it. So don't get too hung up. Don't think that this is the last, as if in reading the book, you didn't realize there were so many more pages left, you know, but just in case it's an audiobook and you're not sure.
The positive value in the case of legal right consists in its being mine as something whose validity is recognized and actual. And at the end, he'll say, consciousness of right, therefore, and the very fact of being recognized as having validity experiences rather the loss of its reality and its complete inessentiality. And to describe an individual as a person is an expression of contempt. And why? Because the actual content or the specific character of what is mine is not contained in this empty form and does not concern it. It's going to end up in the emperor. So you can be a person all you like. So it's positive. I mean, as Seth was pointing out, there's something positive about it, but also something negative. Rights are recognized in the Republic, but it creates a kind of power vacuum, which makes the collapse into empire inevitable.
The reason for that is that the individual doesn't actually have rights that make it have any content to them, because the rights are bestowed by the rights are in the end owned. The content of them is owned by the state. Is that the deal?
I think it's because people are atomized and thin and they have communitarian longings. And the only way they get that back in this circumstance is through identification with a strongman, through nationalism.
Okay, can get that. But the reason that this is happening in the realm of rights, where you, I would think that, well, part of what you're getting as an individual with rights is you are getting more content. But the deal is that actually it's a thinning out. It's having individuals have rights is really a kind of agent of their atomization. They're being reduced to rights in this kind of abstract way, and as opposed to being whole beings. And so this is what I mean by the rights is in this way, the rights that individuals have, their very atomization is, I mean, I'm reading it as a consequence of, well, it's being bestowed in some way on them by the community as on the nation, and the nation is holding all of the content.
Yeah. I think, right, to have your rights recognized, there's something positive in that, but it's also to be recognized as an end in yourself or as a person is to be only recognized mm-hmm. in that thin version of yourself. It's not to be recognized in your full content, fullness or whatever, as fully having content, as having that little spark that you get out of the divine law. And I think it's a loss of community. It's a loss of national solidarity in its true form. And then, okay, where's the content? Well, we need to find a strong leader to put that content into.
Yeah. Can we just clarify a little more this form versus content distinction that, right, we're saying that these rights are merely formal, property is merely formal. I thought, Dylan, what you were kind of saying is like, unless you give it content, unless you say you have property rights to XYZ, then the sovereign can always come along and say, oh, sure, you have property rights, but you know this particular property is all mine. You have rights, but at my sufferance or something like that. That's a way of saying that they're merely formal, empty, without some actual implementable, protectable measures of redress if the sovereign violates them.
But you, in being recognized as a person, are not being recognized as Mark, and you're not even being recognized as the true Roman that you are, and the inheritor of all Roman glories and Caesar's conquests and things like that. And you're not recognized as the citizen in the older sense of the citizen of a nation, a Volk, a certain type with certain traditions and all that stuff that people complain that you lose in something that's more liberal.
Okay, so the content is the cultural content and the recognition that goes with that. All right.
Yeah, that's my reading. Yeah.
It seems like there's probably something more technical for Hegel, but I'm not exactly sure. Because earlier I was seeing what the difference between, he was like, well, the form in this, you know, divine versus human law is between self-consciousness and the unconscious, but the content is between divine and human law. So that was one place he made that, you know, within our reading for this time. But it seems now he's moved on to something else. I was trying to like stuff those together and say what form is for him in the abstract.
In 481, the dispersed content, right, gets kind of gathered together. It's almost like dust from stars, right, gathering to, or what is it, hydrogen? And dust gets gathered together to make stars, but it gets gathered into one point, which is the emperor, who in a way becomes a symbolic representation of the rigid and empty self. It's also soulless. Dispersion of the content into a sheer multiplicity of personal atoms, gathered into a single point, alien to them and soulless as well. The leader.
Cut off from this multiplicity, the solitary self, this is the Lord, is in fact an unreal, impotent self.
He becomes impotent because he becomes the tyrant and subject to his own destructive desire, his monstrous excesses. He becomes a Nero or a Caligula.
A Caligula, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't think it's that the content of spirit has been dispersed into personal atoms, right? That's the starting point with the breakdown from the Antigone whole thing. And you're just saying, Wes, that then they're gathered up into the general will. But I think that the sovereign is claiming that they're gathered up into his person. But his person is not the general will in Rousseau's sense of like that would be in a well-functioning, harmonious society. This is the alienated soulless. So you can't both say the content of spirit that was distributed has now been gathered up, but also say that that gathering is merely soulless and doesn't have any spirit in it. Like it is a pantomime of gathering.
Yeah, I didn't say general will. And to be gathered into the emperor, right, there is a lot of content to that. And that is right, the glories of Julius Caesar, of course, he doesn't make it, but he is a nascent emperor. And what was it that was so exciting about him? It was all about conquest and the glory of Rome and what that represented. And there's a cult of personality. Ultimately, that got transferred to his nephew, Octavius, Augustus Caesar. So there is a lot of content in the emperor, but at bottom, it becomes something soulless. And I think that it has a lot to do with the devolution into the mere appetite and desire of the emperor.
Yeah. And it's also that it's the opportunity for a thick individual personality, a genuine community isn't there. It's an illusion of that. There's the attractiveness of the Julius Caesar, right? And a kind of partaking of it, but a vicariousness, but it's not anywhere near the same thing as actually being a citizen of that's a full member of the community, participating in the ethical life of the community and founding that ethical life.
It's also, if your absolute spirit, from the perspective of spirit, having that realized in just one atom as opposed to all the atoms is impoverished.
Exactly.
So yeah, this is a necessary step because we have to go through this to create. I mean, in this sense, the emperor is in a sense like the first creation of, it's like, it's the development of self-consciousness. And, you know, as these stages we go through, it's not that every single possible manifestation or realization, actualization of self-consciousness happens in all individuals simultaneously. So yeah, this is a positive development in some sense, but it's still lacking. We would like to have a nation of emperors, right?
In 482, in fact, he destroys his subjects. He further atomizes them, right? I think because they become, the subjects become the objects of his destructive appetites. He robs them of their essence. He destroys their personality. They become without substance. They become merely formal selves in relation to something alienated, right? So alienation continues. And this is that same story where the thing that you think you've solved the problem with some relationship to something above you, but that turns out to be just something from which you're alienated. And as we know from young Hegelians and Feuerbach, that story can be continued indefinitely, right? Because you can say, well, the Hegelian God that we end up with is also not good enough. It's something from which we're alienated. Only when we get to Marx, right, can we figure out how to not be alienated. But yeah, here the Lord just ends up being this another alien being, and we are merely formal selves in relationship to it.
And to each other, right? The individual citizens exist in a merely negative relationship both to one another and to him who is their bond of connection or continuity. So this Hannah Arendt on totalitarianism occurred to me very, right, that you are
Freud on the group.
Yeah.
Yeah. She makes this connection very explicitly. It's atomization is the thing that is a big factor that leads to totalitarianism and is reinforced by totalitarianism.
Although for Freud and the group, you at least get to be in solidarity and connected with your fellow group members, right? Whereas for Arendt, totalitarianism.
But it's mediated through the individual leader. That was the only thing I was saying.
Yeah, but I guess the question is, are you alienated in a Freudian group? You're not necessarily alienated from the leader. Like, hopefully you're not alienated from the leader. That's the whole point is that like you, I believe in Jesus and therefore I have.
You're alienated from yourself. You're alienated from your own individual desires because you adopt the desire of the group as personified by the leader. Mm.
Speaking of which, that's the way it ends in 483 with alienation from the self.
Yep.
This truth consists in the fact that this universally acknowledged authority of self-consciousness is the reality from which it is alienated. Okay, that's the emperor. This acknowledgement of its authority is the universal actuality of the self, but this actuality is directly the perversion of the self as well. It is the loss of its essence. The actuality of the self that did not exist in the ethical world back in the good old days with harmony, right, has been won. So that's the positive part of this, but it's been won by its return into the person. What in the former was harmoniously one now emerges in a developed form, but is alienated from itself. So we didn't really have the full individual in the Greek order. Now we get an actual individual, but only at the cost of alienation.
Right. And that actual individual, the emperor, the reason he parallels it with it's like being, remember when we were talking about Stoicism, it's like, great. The Stoicism recognizes an individual and creates it, but creates solipsism. This is another form of solipsism or another form of skepticism with respect to, except instead of it being to the world and appearances and objects, it's to people, or not people per se, but other individuals. It's a similar kind of structure.
All right, let's wrap it up. So we discussed right before we had this recording, do we want to keep going through Hegel? Some of us want to keep going through Hegel. So this podcast, our next episode, will be on the next section, self-alienated spirit culture. And probably we'll need another two full episodes for that. So if we do that, it'll be four Hegels in a row. Dylan, I know you're jumping off the train as far as the Hegel goes, and we'll be back when we're done with our Hegel. Maybe we can have a nightcap before you come, you know, during your absence, to so people don't miss you too much.
Jumping off the Hegel Express. or probably more accurately, the local, the Hegel local that stops at all the stops.
That Seth was like, well, we don't have to keep going on the podcast, but I'm going to keep going on my own because I'm so excited about this.
Let me just say something to that real quick. I think he's onto something really, really, really deep and fundamental. And the fact that he did it when he did it and pursued it with such persistence and consistency. I recognize that the language is very convoluted and confusing and all this, but I feel like, I guess it did change the course of, you know, philosophy, obviously, but I'm surprised that maybe it was just because he's as hard to read as he is, that it wasn't more impactful. It wasn't like more fundamentally earth-shattering to subsequent philosophy.
I mean, the continental philosophy is, it's just all about beating this dead horse of alienation, right? This, to read this, it's like it you know, really dramatically improves one's reading of Marx and all critical theory, all the stuff that comes in this tradition, post-structuralism as a version of Hegelian idealism, you know, all that stuff. Everything in continental philosophy is informed by this.
Totally agree. I'm just saying, like, how are there aspects of philosophy that are not touched by this? How did we have a non-continental tradition that just completely ignores this? That's what I don't understand, because I think it's like that.
Because there's also atomic facts. Some of us like the atoms. We want to see them dispersed.
I think we have to return to Bradley and Russell if we want to get that story. Dylan, do you have a closing for us before you exit Hegel world about your experience?
So I get the kind of profundity of the insights, particularly the psychological insights that you can unearth out of it. And there's something compelling and interesting about the evolutionary story that he's telling, besides the challenge of the language. In the end, I find it, I mean, distasteful might be the right word. I don't.
It's in poor taste.
I think that his universality and his quest has the same kind of destructive, megalomaniacal kind of view of the world as this unity that I see that he has incredibly perceptive insights into psychology and the relationship between the community and individual and faith and reason and the Enlightenment. But he just still keeps this pursuit of a unifying nature that, while I can admit the communitarian kind of critique and how do we have full selves and have a full community, it's so monolithic in the end that I have a hard time. That's what I find just distasteful of it. And then part of that has the whole evolutionary story he has. I still don't, I mean, I'm not saying that I don't get it isn't quite right. That's why I keep picking this word distasteful. This whole notion, the weirdness of the spirit and what the spirit is and this evolution from the beginning of time, it's really, really weird. It's just deeply fundamentally weird about the way in which he's talking about this. It's religious. I mean, the way he talks about Geist and the story that he's telling, it could be like Genesis, the way he talks about it and even his tone about it. So that's my last word. And in the end, I look at him like, okay, in parts of this, he's like those pictures of Tolstoy that you see, like this, you know, long-haired, raving kind of author. That's what he's like. That's what he feels like. That's not what his picture is, you know, from when he was painted back in 1820. But he's a lunatic. He's a lunatic.
Yeah. Let me just say one word. Yeah. I mean, I think what we know about him from his biography and reaction people to him is he's actually did not come across that way. It's very...
Okay, that's great.
A beloved teacher and much clearer as a teacher. And you can even see it as an encyclopedia in the footnotes and things. He can be clear.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. This book does not feel that way.
Yeah, I would encourage folks to become paying supporters of the Close Reads project that Wes and I did 5 hours just on the unhappy consciousness section and really came to grips with his style. And I think one of the things that we were running into is that you have to take everything and look at it through an epistemic lens, a political lens, a religious lens, a literary lens, like that all of these historical work. Yes, yes, that he is talking in such generality that his seemingly hopelessly abstract language just means that I'm trying to say multiple things here with any given section. So what we talked about today is not just about Antigone. It's about the whole, just the nature of law itself. And that is not something that he can, as many words as he uses, he doesn't really fill that in and say explicitly, you got to, you know, apply these multiple hermeneutics at the same time. It's just that that is how, at least I found the best way to read it, is to sort of return to it with these different, how can I generalize this? How can I make this more than what it's saying? Or more than the, you know, specifically religious, for instance, interpretation that certain words that he's using in this section suggest. All right. Well, thanks for making it this far. For you guys, for the listeners, email us pel@partiallyexaminedlife.com. Check out the blog posts associated with this episode where I try to sum things up. Feel free to reach out to us in any way. Follow us on the various social media. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.